That's a good idea.
So one of the things that occurred to me is you started out at Vanderbilt with an LKB 9000.
Yes.
What I would assume during your tenure there, you purchased other equipment, or?
Yes, we got a. A rebear quadrupole.
Oh, okay. Any particular reason why you chose that instrument?
Well, we had done some tests, and it gave the best results of reproducibility and detection limits. Of those that we tested mm-hmm. at that time, as I recall, that was the reason. And you know, Sparkman was also around and encouraging us to go in that direction. And it did have good resolving power with those big long rods. According to Sparkman, is the reason. But we were just interested in reproducibility and detection of it, and that was satisfactory.
That was a French
yes.
machine, right?
Yes.
Did it perform up to your expectations?
Yes. Yeah, it was quite good.
So, were the specifications for resolving power and mass range pretty much standard for quads at that time?
I'd say so, yeah.
Up to what, like 500? Mass 500?
Or maybe even more.
Oh.
I think.
And was that put in a GCMS environment? Or?
Yes, GCMS.
And did you have to interface that yourself, or did they provide?
I think they must have done that.
They provided some.
Yeah.
MS interface. Okay.
I think so.
Any other instruments while at Vanderbilt or?
No.
And so was the LKB still functioning when you left there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Huh? Well, you know, when you take good care of an instrument, it should last for quite some time.
Yeah.
And you had a pretty good stable of equipment at Michigan State, I would assume.
Yeah.
What had they there, do you recall when you started in after Sweeley? Is it Sweeley that got you out there?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess they had an LKB 9000 there too, didn't they? When you came originally?
Yes, they did.
I thought that was one of the instruments that. I've got a picture of, I think, Sweeley and Rahagi.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in front of a LKB 9000. I guess Rahagi came over or was in the States at one time or another for some event or what, not decided to visit Chuck.
I see. Uh-huh.
Any other instruments that you recall at the time? Or?
Oh, we had a...
GCMS.
We had a JOL
oh, yeah?
HX110,
wow.
Which is double focusing.
Mm-hmm.
A very good instrument. And also a JOL 500, 505 for GCMS.
Oh, okay.
Also performed very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the LKB and the 505 were used for that metabolic profiling that Chuck had developed.
Okay. And he was a biochemist, wasn't he? Biologist or
biochemist. He his interest was in carbohydrates, and and lipids, I guess I should say too.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that you know, he's the kind of person that would have been interesting to talk to.
Indeed.
And do you recall any stories that he told about his career, or any things that would be kind of interesting to people today to know about Chuck Swealy?
Well, of course, he was the guy that promoted the use, or actually demonstrated the utility of trimethylsilyl derivatives of hydroxylated compounds. And he also pioneered the use of stable isotope labeled analogs of what he was studying as internal standards. Some, I think he even used deuterium labeled glucose in some of his initial experiments.
Wow.
But his main theme while at Michigan State was developing this technology of so-called metabolic profiling, which was based on complete scanning of the mass spectrum. And then at designated retention indices, going into that data base and searching for identifying ions, peaks that represented what I think he called marker ions. Mm-hmm. And they had confirming ions, and then constructed an algorithm that pulled quantitative data out of these responses. So it was both qualitative and quantitative.
Important.
And he was very heavily sought after for detection of and identification of metabolic defects.
In the sense
of
the people
enzyme deficiencies that would lead to accumulation of some certain metabolites that would render clinical symptoms.
So when he got you to take over, he headed for the chair of the biochemistry department.
That's correct, yeah, sorry.
Usually, a lot of people see the chairman position as a pain in the can.
I sure would.
He sought it.
That's true, he did. And he did a good job. He was a great chairman.
So basically you were in his department.
That's right. He was also very careful, because he was easily criticized for giving favoritism to the mass spec facility.
Oh,
okay. So he was very careful. He was actually hard on us.
Yes.
But he gave important support when needed. Hmm. Both at site visits. He was worth his weight in gold at site visits. Yeah, he put on quite a show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how big was the department that he was running then? I mean, the mass spec facility was just part of the
operation. Oh, yeah. Yeah, the biochemistry faculty numbered the order of 40 faculty, including those that had appointments in other departments as well. But it's a big operation. And biochemistry was and still is one of the best departments on campus in terms of productivity, publications, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And so he maintained that position for probably, what, into the 90s? Or,
yes.
Before he retired from running the show.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know exactly when. I can't remember the date that he retired, but...
Now, was he was... I remember they did this multiple hand monitoring.
That's right.
Activity. That was something that came out of Michigan State, wasn't it?
Well, to some extent, he actually did that in Stockholm with Rihagi.
Ah, okay.
He called it alternating acceleration voltage.
Uh-huh.
AVA. AVA, what was it? Alternating. Yeah. Alternating acceleration voltage. That was AVA. That's what that meant. That allowed him to do multiple ion monitoring. But his big thing was this metabolic profiling, which was based on complete scan.
Mm-hmm.
And processing arrays of complete mass spectra.
Kind of like a preview of what's going on nowadays with the...
Metabolomics? Metabolomics?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of a precursor to metabolomics.
Yeah. Today's metabolomics is heavily dependent upon data processing.
Yeah. Yes, well, the problem today is there's so much data processed and produced that who knows, does anybody ever really understand everything or anything? A lot of times people end up, publishing stuff that has a rough time with reviewers. Did you have any particularly interesting or unhappy experiences when you're trying to get something that you think is valuable out and the reviewer just pans it because he doesn't even either misses a point or that happens to some people. But
oh, you mean me as an author?
Yeah, you as an author writing, papers, scientific papers. And
yeah. No, I fare fairly well with that.
No, that's good.
Yeah.
Some people get,
I got as many critiques as I could before I let anything out. Locally. I didn't, even including grants, I didn't want to hear how good something was until after I mailed it off. Before that, I wanted as much criticism as possible.
Okay.
So that I could
make it better.
Deal with it before it got in some remote smoking room behind closed doors where you can't defend yourself.
Wouldn't have somebody come out of the work on something that you couldn't, like you say, couldn't defend if because you hadn't thought about it or hadn't seen it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think there are any particularly upsetting or bad events, you might say, in your career that had an effect on your career, or just, everything was hunky-dory? I mean, it's a lot of work, but that's not a bad event.
Yeah.
Part of the game.
I'm afraid that's right.
That's right?
That's right.
Yeah.
I had a good run.
Well, particularly after you got to Michigan State, when you can get graduate students.
I had a good number. I mean, well, like you saw, I showed you downstairs that plaque.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I had some 40 or so graduate students, and it was a real beehive.
Yeah.
In the facility.
So how many did you like to have at a time? Obviously, there's a balancing act between.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a few.
Absolutely.
So I mean, you like 3 to 6, or?
I like somewhere between 6 and 12.
Oh, that's a fairly large number.
Yeah. But it's good to have a large enough group so that the oldsters can teach the youngsters the ropes of the laboratory.
Uh-huh.
And that keeps the momentum.
Uh-huh. What about, I know it seems more common nowadays to have undergraduate research being conducted. Did you have any undergraduates?
Oh, yes.
Really? Okay. Did that represent, did they find the experience sufficiently exciting to go on in science or to go on to graduate work?
Yeah, you know, especially there was a young man, Curtis Pickering, who was from Flint area, and he had he was outstanding. Came to the lab, learned how to run the GCMS instruments and the MSMS quickly, and participated almost immediately as a TA for our ACS short course.
Oh, wow.
And he went on to a PhD program at UCSF in biochemistry.
That would be with Burlingame there then? UCSF or?
Yeah, but Burlingame had nothing to do with the project he's working on.
Okay.
It's I think even a molecular biology type project he's working on. I forgot the details.
Mm-hmm.
But he was highly motivated and very capable undergrad, left us in good shape, and I'm confident he'll do well.
Mm-hmm.
In both making contributions and being successful.
So with 40 graduate students, you had to develop some mentoring skills, shall we say. Or was there any particular... And you also, I mean, obviously you're also kind of a bit of a psychologist. Because
yeah.
People come in with totally different ideas of what constitutes work.
That's a good point.
And what constitutes, getting the job done. How did you develop, what was your mentoring style?
Well,
I mean, some people just throw them in a gemisch and say, survive, which is a style, but I don't think I suggest.
I usually would start a new grad student out as an assistant to a senior graduate student to help out with some of the mundane experiments as a means of learning the technology.
Mm-hmm.
And I put a high priority on group meetings, which we had every Friday afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And they were I made sure that they were very informal.
Mm-hmm.
And people could discuss things openly and take advantage of all of the other brains in the room in terms of critique. I would go around after a given student would make a presentation of the work that they'd done since the last group meeting, then we'd have question session. Everyone would ask a question, go around the room, and also going around the room, we'd ask for the other graduate students would be asked to make suggestions on how to maybe pursue an alternate approach to the problem and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a learning experience for everybody, and also it took advantage of some of the analytical minds that were there, and it made the group strong. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of buddy systems going on.
Mm-hmm. What about you? Must have had some postdocs at the lab, I would imagine.
Oh yes.
So they were probably also helped out in the mentoring business, I guess, by, as you say.
Well, they would all, the postdocs would also attend the group meetings, of course, mm-hmm. and there were some projects where the postdocs would, and as well as a grad student, would work on the same project to some extent, or facets thereof. Mm-hmm. And then you're right. I mean, in many cases the ideal postdoc could very well be a replacement for me in certain cases, especially if I were going out of town on a study section meeting or on sabbatical even. So there was good continuity that way.
Yeah, these normally postdocs would come in for what, a one or 2 year appointment,
at least,
and move on.
Oh, minimum of 2 years.
Minimum of 2 years. It's hard to do much in a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so postdoc might be there three 4 years.
Oh, okay. And this was funding that you had to get though. You had to provide the funding for these guys, right?
Yes.
So that was a requirement.
Yeah. Well, and early on that came through the training part of the resource, but later on it was simply part of my R01s, which was a great relief to write the R01 grants as opposed to the telephone book sized grant applications for the research resource,
yeah,
which was just sometimes unmanageable, yeah, amount of administrative detail.
Yeah. I often wondered if anybody ever read those things besides the people who prepared them.
Mm.
So your funding came primarily from the research grant and some R01 grants?
Yes.
Okay. Those are mostly all NIH, I assume.
Yes.
Okay. You didn't try for DOD or NIH or...
You mean NSF?
NSF.
No.
And your resource had a lot of training, but also did you run samples for outside schools and so on and so forth?
Oh, yes. We had a service program.
Okay. I always thought that was an important part of the activity. Oh, I think some of the resources treat that as a not to be bothered with very much.
Yeah.
Activity.
Yeah. Well, that's the manager of the facility was to interface with the users, and we had on campus users and off-campus users, mm-hmm. and the service manager was heavily involved with the off-campus mm-hmm. researchers, mm-hmm. in planning the experiment so that the samples would be prepared properly for analysis,
yeah.
and then the data analysis.
Yeah, we did. I see also the opportunity to train students on different equipment. I remember in our group, you know, a student would be on a project in which he used one piece of equipment extensively. And it was through the service project that he got to use
good point.
The other instruments in the lab, you know, because maybe the sample that was being submitted wasn't amenable to the instrumentation that he was most familiar with. And so... A lot of these new guys didn't particularly care to get service samples where they had to use the old magnetic sector dog.
Yeah.
But But they learned.
But one thing, to that point, there are participation in the ACS short course, laboratory short course sessions, where you asked or required the grad students to be teaching assistants in that context. That gave them opportunity to use a wider variety of instruments and techniques than they would otherwise have had exposure to in the context of their dissertation research.
Sure.
So it was a good symbiotic relationship.
Well, I think it is important that these people come away learning or knowing more about other mass spectrometers than the one that they just did their research with or used in their research.
Yeah.
Because it just makes them a lot more, I think, valuable in the... Did you get any financial support for the operation or your research from Michigan State, or was it all soft money?
Well, we got some local money through sort of a fee for service type arrangement with on campus non NIH users.
Okay.
And
but the school per se didn't.
Not when I was in charge. Okay. They finally have committed substantial continuing support for the mass spec facility as being a campus wide analytical facility.
Okay.
Sort of a line item for that these days. But during my tenure, it was quite variable.
Yeah, well, money is there's always money to be had in different places.
And yeah,
getting it is always interesting and challenging. I was curious. Now you spent some time. Before I get to that, did you ever write any of these research instrumentation grants where you're asking for money to help buy a piece of equipment? This seems to be a specialty in the Gross Lab where they are able to go to NIH or I guess mostly NIH and get funds for instrumentation.
Oh yes, we did that, and we also tapped the DOE.
Okay.
Michigan State is especially rich in plant science.
Oh.
And DOE has had an interest in the plant research projects, and they had a instrumentation request for proposals, and it was in that context I spent most of the Christmas vacation break in about 1997, roughly, writing a grant that turned out to be one of the largest grants ever made by DOE to a university.
Oh, wow.
We used those funds to purchase the JEOL double focusing mass spectrometer, which was high resolution and good for exact mass measurements, and had a fab source, and a collision cell for collision activated dissociation.
Mm-hmm. Did you say MS work?
Yes.
Yeah, I guess that's a problem or a requirement is to be able to write these instrumentation grants and to get support for buying equipment. It's most equipment, I guess, is running $1 million range now.
Well, that's bad, yes.
Which is, money is getting harder and harder to get from the government. Now, you had a lot of activity or involvement in a fraternity when you were an undergraduate, but you also were involved in society, professional society, well, I guess ACS and ASMS, in your professional career. You said you were on the board of ASMS for
a year or so, I guess.
And that was what, member at large? Or?
Yeah, I was, yes, correct. I was member at large.
Yeah.
And I.
How was that experience? Was it?
Well, you know, ASMS is a. I've seen it grow from. My first meeting was with the E14 part of ASTM in 1964. It was in McGill University in Montreal.
Oh, yeah.
There were 200 people at the whole meeting.
Yeah.
And.
What, one oral session?
I think so. I think that's right. No competition.
Yeah. Now it's what?
What's the number? 5,000 or 6,000.
5,000 or 6,000, yeah. With too many multiple sessions to keep up with, it's ridiculous.
Well, but that's thankfully mitigated to some extent by this webcast program that they have, which combines the video with the audio. It makes it available online to attendees. A very valuable service.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, they've got to do something because there's so much of interest going on.
In parallel. Yeah.
Did you serve any other positions with ASMS or?
No.
Besides the member at large, okay.
Yeah.
Nowadays, a member at large has a specific.
That's right.
Focus.
Yeah.
Point. You were.
I was just Burnaby Munson was the president, and I just did what needed to be done at his disposal. I think I did something silly like a salary survey or something.
Oh.
But I guess that seemed to be of interest to the membership.
And your ACS activities are primarily in the short course on mass spec, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You never got involved in the more political aspects of the American Chemical Society.
No.
I wish their meetings weren't so expensive. I mean, ASMS is really nice because it's affordable.
Yeah.
Did you develop any instrumentation that would go beyond, the lab into something that might be marketed or patented? Or
no.
In that way?
No.
So that was.
I guess the separator was the closest thing, but we were advised that there wouldn't be a big enough market to make it worth patenting.
That's always the story.
So that's okay with me.
Yeah. Well, it's another big piece of paperwork.
Yeah, that's a good point.
No. Analytical chemistry is kind of a discipline that's going by the by in a lot of schools these days. It's looked down on, some, I think, to a certain extent. Was there actually a program in analytical chemistry at Michigan State? Or
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Do they still have that going?
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Because I know a lot of schools kind of, well, I guess MIT moved away from their analytical chemistry.
I think that's right. And
I mean, I was kind of surprised when Beeman left that the lab was disbanded. It seemed to, you know, like, I guess that they didn't want to.
Yeah, that was a strange situation. But I think Kathy took most of the equipment over to BU.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that was, I mean, you know, that was a good move for her and for mass spec. I guess MIT just figured they didn't want to deal with it anymore. I don't know. Well, I mean, things change.
Yeah. I don't know the details, but I suspect you're right.
Yeah. But the thing that always amazes me is, as I've mentioned before in some other interviews, is that if you know, analytical chemistry, is sometimes people kind of look down on that as a discipline, but if you can't tell the synthetic chemist, if he doesn't know what he's got, what he made, he can't figure out what it is, if he can't have some method of proving that, you know, analyzing it in a way that would unequivocally demonstrate what he made, it seems like he's kind of out of luck.
Yeah, that's a good point.
They accept the fact that they can get this information as just part of life, you know, it's like the regular routine.
Hmm.
But analytical chemists made it happen.
Yeah,
and
that's a good point.
They should get a little more respect.
Yeah.
So, you said that they still do have an active program in analytical chemistry at Michigan State.
Oh, yes.
That's good.
Yes.
I think, well, Purdue does still.
I sure do.
I guess all the places that have research resources probably have a strong analytical chemistry. Now, we talked about some of these people. I was going to touch base with you on Douglas Gage. He mentored you somewhere along the way. Is that not correct, or did I?
I beg your, say again?
Douglas Gage.
Yeah.
Was he a mentor?
No.
No, okay.
No, he was a postdoc in the plant science part of Michigan State, and was interested and used our facility and proved himself to be quite knowledgeable in the interpretation of mass spectral data for his purpose. And so when we needed a manager to replace Brian Musselman, we offered Doug the opportunity to join us as manager, service manager, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
as Doug had a good rapport with the users and became a collaborator effectively with them, and Doug is a strong background in metabolism, especially as it applies to plants.
Uh-huh.
So he was a valuable resource to those users, and as well as a representative of the mass spectrometry facility at MSU. So it was a good symbiotic relationship, so to speak.
You did some work with Brian Sweetman at Vanderbilt, as I recall.
Brian Sweetman?
Yeah.
Yeah, he confused me there for a minute. Yes, well, Brian was a postdoc with me at Michigan State, at Vanderbilt, yes.
Still in the clinical aspects of pharmacology, or?
I guess, you know, I think Brian remained as part of the prostaglandin analysis quantitation program.
Yeah, prostaglandin. That was a big part of a big theme in the
Yeah, that was,
Vanderbilt. Yeah.
Yeah, I've lost track of Brian.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people that you interact with over time, so.
Yes.
I think we talked about John Allison. He was at Michigan State, right?
Yeah, well, he's no longer at Michigan State. He left about 5 years ago. It is at the College of New Jersey.
Oh.
Out in the East Coast. And he's heavily into forensic applications of mass spectrometry.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. The CSI guy?
Yeah. He had some interesting ideas about using MALDI to assess ink used by various ballpoint pens and so forth.
Oh, wow.
He identified an oxidation product of the ink that accumulated as a function of time.
Oh, my.
So that one could determine the age, basically, of certain documents that had been signed.
Yeah.
It was very clever.
Yeah, that could be important. And, like a document was supposed to be signed 10 years ago, but it turned out it was signed 10 days ago. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, John was a good scientist. He is a good scientist. He was a physical chemist before he came to Michigan State, and was a good colleague.
There's another name that seems to come from the past when I see it. It's John Holland.
Jack Holland, yeah.
Jack, okay.
Yeah, John F. Holland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was your collaboration?
Well, he and I basically ran the mass spec facility. I was director and he was co-director.
Oh, okay.
And he was a valuable colleague, a great consultant for both managerial problems or managerial issues with personnel and in terms of computing and developing means of rapid data acquisition. His main contribution to the center grant was the conception of an integrating transient recorder, allowing us to use a time-of-flight mass spectrometer to collect rapid acquisition of complete spectra, such that one could acquire several hundred mass spectra per second. And that's now been commercialized in part by a company over in St. Joe. Michigan, yeah. And I can't think of the name right now. That's something I could supply to you offline.
So that does raise an interesting question. That is that, you know, this whole period of your career is when computers came from little clunky boxes with 16K of memory to really powerful tools. When was the first computer you had dedicated to a mass spectrometer? I mean, it didn't come with the LKB 9000, did it?
No. It did not, but soon thereafter we got the PDP-12 was dedicated to, in fact, we did use it on the LKB, it seems to me, I recall, but it was more readily amenable to the quadrupole instruments that we had.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's a company that flourished and then withered away totally.
Digital Equipment Corporation?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was...
They were the top dog in many small computer business.
That's right. Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that.
But they somehow missed the boat once the PC came.
Is that what it was?
Well, it seemed like they were trying to compete with, you know, when Apple and IBM came out with their personal computers. They tried to compete in that market and they failed. And then the whole mini computer thing, for some reason or other, just totally evaporated. I was using PDP equipment at WashU that was years old, and there's some Data General equipment on the old MS-50. But those were, you know, that style or computing kind of just evaporated and disappeared. It was kind of like stuck between a big computing center computer and a small personal computer. And that little middle ground just came out from under them.
Pinched.
Now your personal computer has got as much memory as, more memory than those old style centralized big computer facilities. So then you were able to take advantage of the computer revolution and data acquisition and analysis.
Yes, that one of the main projects in the Center Grant was this use of this integrating transmit recorder to accumulate full mass range spectra at a very rapid rate.
This was off the time of flight, I guess.
Correct.
And it worked well enough to go into commercial.
We called it time array detection.
Oh, okay. Sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. You go into Walgreens and buy a gig of memory for $19.95. It's like, okay.
Yes.
Is that ridiculous or what?
Yeah. That's pretty good. Well, should we...
want to break it down?
I think, should we move on to... going on Dusty's?